We are fickle creatures, we humans. Our attention spans are short. We lose focus. We get distracted. We have a hard time concentrating on what's truly important. And our spiritual enemies play on this tendency. Sure, Satan would like to get us deeply sunk in the mire of sinful behavior. He'll go with that, sure. But I believe he is satisfied if he can at least get us to take our eyes off of the primary spiritual issues of life. If he can bog us down, even in matters that have some validity but are relatively minor, then he can prevent the pursuit of Christ's calling that is our chief duty. That's what he's really after. We see the attempts of the enemy along these lines in various portions of Scripture. There is Nehemiah rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem. He was always being challenged to leave the work, to parley with this or that opponent. He was told that his work was no good, that he would never finish, but he persevered. His response was, "I cannot come down. I can't stop doing what God has given me to do." He ignored the naysayers. He plugged away at the tasks that he had received. We have the example of the prophets, such as Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah. They kept preaching the word, even though virtually no one listened. The kings would normally try to shut them up one way or another, but they remained faithful until what was usually the bitter end, whether in martyrdom or in captivity. Today we have a similar situation for Gideon. He is to pursue his calling, which is to deliver Israel completely from the hands of the Midianites. He has been used in a mighty way already. As we come to our passage, we've been seeing that. Thousands upon thousands of the enemy lie dead on the ground. The temptation would be to call well enough good. We've won. They fled. They're gone. But there is a pursuit before him that must be continued. Distractions will arise for Gideon. Will he be sidetracked from obeying his commission from God? Let's see how he responds and what we can learn from that as we get into the explanation of God's word. We've had verses 23 through 8:3 read for us. We won't go over that again, but that's where we are in our first area here. We said previously that God takes various approaches in using men to accomplish his will. God used some pitcher breaking and trumpet blowing and torch holding to cause the Midianites to slaughter each other. Now that the opposition is decimated and fleeing, God uses what we might call more normal means of warfare for the completion of the victory. The Jews must pursue, corner, and finish off the Midianites and their cohorts. And they are to do that with the sword. Whereas God only wanted 301 people involved before, he now wants many others to join in this important work. Men from the northern tribes are once again summoned. We can reasonably figure that these were mostly the men who had been dismissed earlier, so that it could be clear that God was the one who was bringing victory to his people. Now God does desire their service. Okay, well, this is God's prerogative. This is how he works. We never know when or where God might want to use us. He told these people, no, I don't need you. Now he says, hey, come on back. We've got some other things for you to do. We simply need to be prepared to heed God's call for our lives, you know, when our name is uttered. One new group is invited to join the pursuit at this point. Remember that in the initial summons, Gideon did not call the tribe of Ephraim to the battle. Now they can be of great help. The Midianites are fleeing southeast to get across the Jordan River and back to their home country. If the tribe of Ephraim would come down out of the hills and guard the fords, the enemy would be cut off. And if this rings a bell with you, it is because this is the very strategy that Ehud employed many years before, back a few chapters in Judges. The tribe of Ephraim cut off the Moabites at that time, farther south along the Jordan, and destroyed them. Same strategy here. And Ephraim complies with the summons, and they have great success. They hunt down two of the Midianite leaders, kill them, and bring these somewhat grisly trophies to Gideon. This was actually a very signal accomplishment here. We read about this and it has a little interest to us, but it seems to be just, you know, kind of part of the flow, go by it fairly quickly. But this is actually memorialized in Psalm 83:11. Reading from that, Psalm 83:11, the verse here says, make their nobles, it's talking about some other enemies, make their nobles like Oreb and Zeb, and all their princes like Zeba and Zalmunna. So here in the midst of looking to God for how God's people would like a victory here against their enemies, he's saying, we'd like it to happen just like what happened with Oreb and Zeb back in the days of Gideon. So this was seen as a very important moment in victory. But despite all the good things that are happening, it's all good. The vast majority of the Midianites already dead. These ones have been blocked off and defeated. It should be a time of great celebration. A sour note is being struck among God's people. How typical is that? It so often happens. The potential arises for the focus to be on hurt feelings within rather than the mission without. A strategy of the enemy, and something that we've all probably experienced if we've been around the church very, very long, is a big distraction, a hindrance to what we're trying to do is, we're having problems with the way we feel we're being treated. And so these, you know, you get the circular firing squad going. And meanwhile, you know, the Lord's work, the important things, get delayed. The men of Ephraim angrily confront Gideon. They're hot. What did he mean by not calling them to the original battle? What an offense. They believe they've been slighted. They've been insulted. Now, it's helpful at this point to bring in some background material on Ephraim. This isn't just, you know, coming out of the blue here. Ephraim was the most numerous of all the Jewish tribes, and they had the largest amount of territory, which kind of reflected that. Living in the hills as they did, they tended to be less affected, less constrained by the various occupiers and raiders of Israel that would come in. They were less affected than other tribes because of their location, harder to get at. They also had the religious centers of Bethel and Shiloh within their borders. To top it all off, Ephraim had been given supremacy over Manasseh, his older brother. And we can go back to Genesis chapter 48 about this and the prophecies that were made about the sons from whom these tribes would come. Genesis 48, verses 17 through 20. When Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him, and he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Hey, Dad, you're doing this wrong. It's supposed to be the older one, grandson, of course, to him. So Joseph's trying to correct his father. Joseph said to his father, "No, so my father, for this one is the firstborn, place your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son." He's like, I know what, you know, why you're having a problem with this. "He will also become a people and also will be great. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." He blessed them that day, saying, "By you Israel will pronounce blessings, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh." Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. Okay, so one of these things that we actually almost come to expect in Scripture, where God does a little change-a-roo and says, "No, it's not going to be the way that you think it's going to be. I have my own plans for who I want to have the foremost position here." So you put all this together that I've been talking about, and Ephraim had become used to having things as its way. Okay. It was supposed to be the blessed one, the one with the privileges and so forth. Become proud, become jealous of its privileges. That's often what happens. Instead of sensing the responsibility that God is giving to us by putting us in that position, it's, you know, "Oh, hey, you know, I should always be first, and don't slight me," and all of this. So they're having a very prideful reaction. And sadly, that pride of Ephraim would eventually bring about its downfall. After the days of Solomon, Ephraim would become synonymous with the wicked kingdom of Israel. Sometimes that northern kingdom is just spoken of as Ephraim. Even though there were nine other tribes in that kingdom, it was sadly foremost in disobedience. Isaiah would preach against the pride and arrogance of Ephraim in Isaiah 9:9. Hosea would describe the tribe as unfit for their position of leadership. I know there's just such a lesson here for pastors, for dads, for people who are in authority, who's like, you know, "Well, hey, you know, the Bible says I'm the man, and I'm supposed to do this, that, and the other thing," and that there's obviously truth to that, but are we fulfilling the responsibilities of our position of leadership? Are we seeking the Lord for that? Do we care as much about that as what the Bible's telling us about the privileges of a given position? And we do see signs of this pride here in the way that Ephraim is relating to Gideon. And from which tribe was Gideon? He was from Manasseh. Okay. So this is bringing up a lot of background. The men of Ephraim are bent out of shape because the one who's supposed to be the lesser brother, you know, here's the leader of the tribe of the lesser brother, you know, they've been leading the charge without them. So there's kind of a sibling rivalry involved here. Now, we don't know the reasons for Gideon's decision not to call upon Ephraim originally. We know for sure that God did not want Ephraim at Jezreel. He sent away most of those who did come. And if Ephraim had been there, then what? They would not have been in position to cut off the Midianites at the fords of the Jordan. So, if nothing else, it should have been very clear to the Ephraimites that Gideon was God's chosen man of the hour. And they needed to submit to what God was doing through him, not come and challenge it immediately in the midst of all this victory that God was giving them. They just have no perspective, and we often fall into that. All we're thinking about is ourselves, and you know, we feel like we didn't get our share, our due, our respect, whatever it is. And meanwhile, God's doing this great work that we're completely missing out on. The truths of God's sovereign working through all the elements here, it's lost on the tribe. All they care about is their own reputation. Well, to Gideon's great credit, he does not become angry in turn. I think we could all, you know, have a thought of some things that you might like to say in response to this. You've got to be kidding me type stuff. But, you know, even though he had good reason to come down on them like a ton of bricks, he's not going to allow God's work to be derailed from that by doing that, okay? It's like, okay, he had to a degree a right to respond in a certain way, but again, what's going to help the larger perspective? The pursuit of the mission was more important than who was getting the credit right now. And so Gideon gives us, I think, a classic illustration of a soft answer turning away wrath. Although the reproach that he's received is totally undeserved. He doesn't spend time defending himself and so forth and justifying what he did. He just responds humbly. What have I done that could be compared to you? He says. This is really interesting. And essentially he's saying, hey, all I did over there was just, I stood and I blew on a trumpet, and God did all of the work. You, on the other hand, you, Ephraim, you've done some real work here. You've taken care of the princes of Midian. That was the important stuff. Your valiant efforts, those are the ones that are going to be remembered as the greatest. We're already working on the Song of Ephraim here. Don't worry about, you know, your reputation. It's secure. And this perspective that he had calms down the men of Ephraim. You can almost hear them saying, you know what? He's right. You know, that is a great point. You know, we really have done the most here, haven't we? You know, that Gideon, he's a lot smarter than I thought he was. He's not such a bad guy. It's a great lesson on how to deal with those who are even inappropriately angry. Gideon passes a stern test here. I mean, this is a big test of leadership. He passes it with flying colors. Rather than be distracted over the concern for his own reputation, which would have been so easy, he gives a self-effacing reply and essentially says, let's get on with the business at hand. We shall see later in this book that another judge faces this same kind of test from a jealous Ephraim, and we'll see whether he responds as wisely as did Gideon. There's much more for Gideon to do here. He's into the pursuit, not into his own reputation. Though he and his trusty band of 300 are weary, they continue the pursuit of the enemy. Not content to merely chase the Midianites across the Jordan, they go over to the other side, and the chase continues. After all, the call from the Lord back in 7:7 was that the Midianites would be given into the hands of the 300 men. They were the ones who were specially chosen to make this pursuit. So Gideon will persevere until the job is finished. He knows what the Lord has told them to do, and he's going to stay focused. So let's look at verses 4 through 12. Then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the Jordan and crossed over, weary yet pursuing. He said to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who are following me, for they are weary, and I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna." Remember, those were the other names in the psalm that I just read. So these four were the main princes they had to get. The kings of Midian, the leaders of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army?" Gideon said, "All right. When the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." He went up from there to Penuel and spoke similarly to them. And the men of Penuel answered him just as the men of Succoth had answered. So he spoke also to the men of Penuel, saying, "When I return safely, I will tear down this tower." Now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their armies with them, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the entire army of the sons of the east, for the fallen were 120,000 swordsmen. Gideon went up by the way of those who lived in tents on the east of Noba and Jogbeha, and attacked the camp when the camp was unsuspecting. When Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. The pursuit brings Gideon into the territory of Gad, to the east of the Jordan. Coming to the town of Succoth, he asks for physical provision so that Gideon's men will be able to keep up the chase. This place was among the first to experience the depredation of the raiders each year. They would come from the east, so they would start with the tribes across the Jordan and then sweep on in. So they were always part of the raiding picture. And you would expect then that they would be very enthusiastic in their generosity. We're really tired of this, and thanks for helping us out and so forth. No. The Gadites are unwilling to help. Despite the fact that Gideon has clearly won a great victory, they still fear the Midianites more than they fear Gideon, and ultimately more than they fear the Lord. Rather than praise Gideon for taking care of the enemy, again, Gideon's just, he's just getting hits from all over. Okay, you want to be a leader? That's the way it's going to go. You're not going to be overburdened with praise for what you're doing. What do these Gadites see? 301 fatigued men, really hungry, looking like they're about all in. And they figure, you know what? You know, they make this calculation, totally from the fleshly perspective. We're going to cast our lot with the 15,000 Midianites that we know are still on the loose. 301, 15,000, these are the guys that are always coming in and doing this stuff to us. No. From the perspective of human wisdom, it seemed like the expedient thing to do was say, forget it. The raiders might be back soon, certainly next year. And maybe with a little extra malice toward those who had helped out Gideon, we're not getting into that. But like the town of Meroz in chapter 5, remember the song of Deborah and Barak, and they were praising different, and but Meroz, no, you know, they got the curse and so forth. These people find themselves fighting against God, saying no to Gideon, the Lord's chosen representative. That was saying no to the Lord. Therefore, they will experience his discipline. Should Gideon take time for that duty now? No, he can't. That'll be next time. Again, he can't allow himself to be distracted from the main issue at this time. Even though the task of disciplining these people would be a worthy one, at this time he must simply give a warning, which in itself shows great faith. This is what's going to happen to you, because I know the Lord's going to give us success. But Gideon's got to move on. Next up is the town of Penuel. And it's a replay of Succoth. He's got to be thinking, can I find any of my own brethren that are going to work with me here? These townspeople apparently holed up in a tower and dared Gideon to do something about it. Again, he doesn't get distracted. I think it would be, it'd been so tempting to say, all right, you know, and start pounding on the tower, or, you know, whatever. But more callous disregard from fellow Jews. Now, there'd be time for handing out the discipline later. Can't let my own, you know, anger at these people get me off course. Got to keep my eye on the ball here. And note the statement, when I return. It is not, if I return, if we should somehow happen, you know, to have success or whatever. He's confident in God's revealed plan. This, now we're really seeing that trusting side of Gideon, right? You know, we've seen some of the things that it's like, okay, you don't really want to imitate that. But we're really getting the faithful hall of faith Gideon going here. The remnant of the Midianite force flees all the way to Karkor. You know where that is. Karkor, before they feel safe. Well, this was a place well east of the Dead Sea. This is at least 100 miles from Jezreel, okay? I mean, you know, to us that might not seem that far, you know. In that day, you get 100 miles away and you're feeling, okay, this ought to be safe. Surely we can let our guard down, you know, way out here in the wilderness. But Gideon's band is still hot on the trail. And they were probably thinking, well, there were only 300 of them, right? Anyway, you know, I mean, there weren't that many. They use a caravan route, does Gideon's group, through the desert to come upon the camp from an unexpected direction, and they launch a surprise attack. So in this case, God uses what we would call, you know, a military strategy. Okay, they used their brains, came up with this idea, and God said, okay, I'll use that as the means this time. You don't, you know, you broke your pitcher, so we don't have that, you know, and we'll use this. But once again, I mean, this is a rout and a slaughter that is against any odds of the numbers still. I mean, no matter how good your strategy is, you know, 300 people, you know, against 15,000, normally you would not expect a great victory. But that is what occurs. Two Midianite kings captured. Gideon has pursued his calling all the way to the end, and he's reaping the reward of his perseverance. Yahweh is glorified through this. He's the true God who does deliver his people by his power. No harmonization this morning. We're going to go right to a couple of applications that I want to make from our passage. And the first flows from the confrontation between Ephraim and Gideon. We learn a couple of things here for our own lives. Sometimes we find ourselves in the position of Ephraim. Okay? We've been there. A decision that someone has made, someone in authority typically, well, it doesn't sit right with us. We're not being included like we should be. Hey, you didn't consult me before you made that decision. You didn't seek my input, and so I think I'm getting the short end here. And we're not being respected like we should be. Before we contend vigorously, you know, as the Ephraimites did, we ought to consider the source of our anger. What's really getting us so worked up? We talked a little bit in Sunday school about what gets us flaring. If all that's getting us hot and bothered is our own reputation, or the fact that, you know, our own agenda is not being pursued like we would wish, then we're on shaky ground with our anger. We're likely to end up being more of a distraction to the Lord's work than being a help. And we should be especially careful about contending with those that the Lord has put in leadership. And again, this is always going to get down to trust. Do you trust God to take care of you if you are submitting to what He's doing, even through a fleshly authority? Can you trust God with that? That it doesn't, in that sense, really matter what boneheaded decisions they're making, because God gives you what He's going to give you. God takes care of you. He's going to do that regardless. Discouraging a person in authority who already has a lot on his mind, as Gideon did here, and all these people are just discouraging him and as he's trying to do his absolute best to serve the Lord. You know, when you're doing that for self-centered reasons, you're really taking on a great responsibility before the Lord. You don't really want to be in that position. There's going to be discipline when you're discouraging your authorities just for your own selfish reasons. Again, we'll see the extent of that coming up, not today. Of course, there is a time when we need to correct and exhort as appropriate in the given relationship. And leaders need this as well as anyone else. We're not, you know, immune from being corrected. But we need to be as sure as possible that our passion is not, you know, for getting our own way. That's really what it comes down to, is we want our own way. Our passion has to be for God's truth, for God's glory. As we've said before, Jesus was the perfect example in these matters. He didn't flare up when His own reputation was involved. That's not when He really went after it. But when He saw perverted worship, when He saw deceptive practices that were truly hurting other people, when He saw the robbing of God's honor, then He became very zealous. And He could clear out the temple courts over those issues. Okay, so that's when we're in the position of Ephraim. At other times, we might find ourselves in the position of Gideon. We're confronted by someone who is angry, someone who feels slighted, and the charge against us might very well be undeserved, as it was with Gideon. How do we respond? Well, the Scriptures are clear on this. We've already alluded to Proverbs 15:1. I can read that. Proverbs 15:1, a gentle answer, sometimes known as a soft answer, turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Just imagine if Gideon had said, don't be coming off on me with that old prophecy stuff. How I'm supposed to be submissive to you. I mean, who knows where that could have gone? Bad. I mean, nothing good. We know it wouldn't have been good. A harsh answer would have stirred that all up, but he gives up. 15:4, a soothing tongue is a tree of life, but perversion in it crushes the spirit. Proverbs 16:32, he who is slow to anger is better than the mighty. You want to be someone who God sees as just, a superman? slow to anger. He who rules his spirit is better than he who captures a city. See, he could have captured those places and lost the calling of God. But he ruled his own spirit in the right way. He had self-control. So, okay, there'll be a time, and kept on. 19:11. A man's discretion makes him slow to anger, and it is his glory to overlook a transgression. Do you want to be glorious? Overlook a transgression. Boy, is that out of the spirit of the age? Overlook a transgression? How about Colossians 4:6? Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. It's our responsibility to know how we should respond to people. And that's what we're being told about here. When people attack you in a certain way here, or just as they did with Gideon, know how you're supposed to respond. Let your speech always be with grace. James 1:26. If anyone thinks himself to be religious, we could say spiritual, and yet does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. Pretty plain, clear statement. Spiritual wisdom in confrontation is to reply graciously, humbly, and with restraint. We cannot control other people, and that's an important lesson to learn. You cannot control what other people do. You can't control their reactions, their words, all the things that they do. There's nothing you can do about that in the end. But we can control ourselves by God's grace. Even when the other person is not showing respect and appreciation to us, we can show that to them, and that's what Gideon did, and it turned out wonderfully. Again, do you want God to be pleased with you? God to see you as glorious, etc.? Or, man, you got to look out for number one. We can be very one-sided in the way that we deal with people. This is another little lesson to think about. Ephraim ignored all the good things that could have been said about Gideon. Nothing there. Just the bad thing. The one thing that they could think of, that was all that they wanted to talk about. They went, let's focus on the one thing that we don't like, Gideon. Gideon chose to emphasize what was good about Ephraim, even though much could have been said on the negative side. He downplayed his own contribution. And in doing that, he diffused a tense situation, and the Lord's work went on. Is that what's important? The other area for application, that was all the first one. This will be short. It's the perseverance that we see in Gideon and his trusty band. His pursuit of the Midianites is such a good picture of the Christian life. We try to pursue our calling in ministry. You have one. Christ is calling you to do more than one thing for him, but he has ministries for you to be involved in, and he's worked in your whole life up to this point to make you prepared for that. And as we're seeking to do that, distractions, potential distractions pop up. Oh, give your time and energy to this over here. Wouldn't you really prefer to do that? The difficulty of keeping at this calling. And we seek to pursue our own personal spiritual growth. That's really even more primary than the tasks that we're given. Oh, but you know, These people over here don't like the way we're doing things. These people over here, they don't want to support us in what we believe God's calling us to do. So, do we give up? Do we turn aside? Do we turn inward? I guess I better just protect myself. Or do we remain obedient to Christ and to his call? That was how Gideon and his band were tested as they went along. That's how we'll be tested. It's going to happen. I think that the last three words of verse 4 put, there he fell dead. Okay, I'm not sure if it's top 40 material, but this was their song. And as you read that, blessed is she who did all these things. You know, this is the song that Deborah and Barak composed to celebrate the victory over the Canaanites. If she's twice called blessed, is that God's stamp of approval upon what she did? Well, I understand why some people can be persuaded through these things that, hey, you know, I guess that was the right thing to do. Or is this, again, is it just the inerrant record of Deborah and Barak's opinion in their song? John MacArthur's take on this is that the blessing here involved God's deliverance through Jay, not what she specifically. Out another, you have teaching on the truthfulness of our words about deception and so forth, that you do not find exceptions. You know, in the end, I'm not positive what to make of the details of what Jael did. And I'm sorry if you wanted, you know, the absolute word, but I certainly lean to the view that her deceptions were sinful. That aspect of what she did was wrong. Though her desire to do away with Sisera was not, and that God graciously used all of this for Israel's benefit. You know, I guess in the end, although it might be a little bit trite, I think it's true that it's good to ask yourself, what do I think that Jesus would have done in this situation? You picture Jesus saying, hey, come on into the tent, you know, here's some yogurt, you know, here, get nice and comfy under the rug. I'm indicating to you that you're completely secure here. There's nothing to worry about. I'm on your side, and now I'm killing you. I'm not really seeing that as far as Jesus is at.